Now we turn to the question of mental health and the media. Officials have not released any information on the mental health state of the Sandy Hook Elementary shooter. However, anecdotal information about his behavior and character have led many people to diagnose him with a myriad of mental illnesses. At what point does conjecture lead to stigmatization about people with mental illness? And is it even fair to connect violence with mental illness? We're going to take that up with Dr. Jennifer Stuber, who's an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And, you know, that was the question that had come up almost from the get-go, because as soon as this happened, there were two paths that have emerged in the media. One is gun control and control of guns. And the second question is, we need to do a better job of doing something. And that's where it's left vague, mm-hmm. about mental health in this country. But let's just start with that question of violence and mental illness. People are equating them. They don't really aren't equated at all, are they?
Well, we have to remember in our society that in the course of, if you look at prevalence data on mental illness, that roughly half of all Americans over the course of their lifetime will actually meet diagnostic criteria for mental illness.
And is that right?
In a given year, half over the course of one's lifetime from birth to aging. So that includes things like dementia and Alzheimer's. But then, you know, in any given year, you've got 25% to 30% of the American public experiencing a diagnosis of mental illness. Now, a much smaller proportion, 5% to 6% of the general population, have what's known as a serious mental illness. And that's where, you know, I think, so first off, I just want us to start off by being careful about the fact that when we use that term mental illness, we're talking about a very large percentage of the American population, and frankly, a changing dynamic percentage of our population. All of us are vulnerable to mental illness. All of us have a tipping point. So I think we should be very careful when we link mental illness and violence together.
Are they at all linkable?
I mean, it's individual. When you're talking about serious mental illness, so that 5% to 6% of the population, what the research has shown is that, you know, there are some serious mental illnesses. There's some symptoms. So, for example, with schizophrenia, there are certain kinds of symptoms you can have that can lead people to, you know, have what's known as threat override symptoms, where they're being told by their hallucinations, you know, to do something that could potentially be violent, and sometimes to self-protect themselves. But the reality is, even when you look at people with serious mental illness, the vast majority of people with serious mental illness are not involved in violent crimes. And I think some really great research has emerged that really talks about the fact that mental illness alone is rarely the cause of a violent act. What's really more important is not so much one's mental health state, but the way in which one's context of being brought up, or their past history. So things like, you know, having a mental illness in conjunction with, you know, being bullied and not having exposure to solid parenting, or, you know, also abusing substances. So it's a kind of that complex combination of factors that can sometimes, you know, lead someone with a mental illness to become involved in violent, but it's become involved in a violent crime. But it's really one factor in a larger context, a larger array of things. So when we simplify and we say, you know, the person had a mental illness, or this crime was caused because this person had a history of mental illness, it really does oversimplify things and create the perception, this erroneous false stereotype in society, that there's a link between mental illness and violence, when in reality it's a factor in a very complex situation.
You know, that brings up, I want to stick with that a minute, that brings up something I heard on the radio in a conversation we had, which was a person talking about a family member who had issues with mental health. And so what she saw as her goal was to help that person understand that when something is happening, there are ways to seek help, and that there are opportunities or options, so that the person themselves wouldn't felt empowered. And that's not really the sense you get from the media story, that the person
right
has opportunity and options.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't really know in this case, like, what the opportunity or
no,
options
were. We don't know anything
were.
About this. That's part of the question, isn't it?
Right, right. But we do know that there are a lot of people out there who are experiencing serious mental health challenges. So I'm not just talking about the one in four or the one in two Americans over the course of their life. We know that most people with mental illness actually don't end up seeking treatment, but there are a lot of people with serious mental illness who don't end up seeking treatment. And so part of the challenge is, you know, raising awareness to those individuals, but also educating families, educating communities, educating schools about what resources are available, you know, talking about the fact that treatment works, recovery happens all the time from mental illness, you know, making people aware of the fact that, you know, there is help that's available.
Well, that was the second conversation that I had where somebody said, and this is the fault of the media in general. Media tells stories that are about out of the ordinary, things that are new or mm-hmm. news. But the complaint was, we only hear stories about mental health or mental illness when there's something horrific happening. We never hear the success stories.
Yep.
And that's the other aspect of mental health reporting, I guess we could look at it that way.
Absolutely.
That we need to pursue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two big issues that we hear about and when we're hearing about mental illness in the news concern an incident where there's violence involved or when there's suicide. And so we also know that mental illness and suicide are linked in news are linked, and that's a coverage way in which the news covers the mental illness. So we do need to be hearing a lot more about recovery and treatment, because I think that the predominant portrayal of mental illness is one that is a very negative stereotype, perpetuates violence, unpredictability. And again, that really does discourage people ultimately from seeking help. So in a way, there's an irony here that the media and the way it covers these issues actually contributes to the problem, because it's contributing to that idea that we don't seek help. We don't seek help because we don't talk about the fact that there is treatment, that there is recovery.
Is there a time when it is important to for the press and therefore for the general public to know about a person's mental state in telling a story?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't actually think it's a bad... I think, you know, mental illness can be relevant to a news story about violence. But my complaint is when we kind of make those simple associations between the person had a history of mental illness and we don't talk about the other really important factors in a person's life that might be a play, you know, such as I said, like the context of a person's life, what kind of parenting did they get, were they bullied in school, where, you know, they have parents who are incarcerated, all these other things that we know are really important in shaping a person's life experience and that mental illness can intersect with. So we don't talk about those things enough in the media. And I think certainly talking about when there are system failures in the mental health system is a great topic for the media to be covering. But I think that they also, I think, you know, some of the things we've heard about is that, you know, we really need to be focused on improving mental health systems in this country as a result of this tragedy. And I think that there's some truth to that in the same way that we should be talking about in improving and tightening gun control laws. But I think we have to recognize that the mental health system has always been underfunded in this country. That's not the cause of this problem necessarily. The mental health system has, you know, for the last 100 years, and you know, we just haven't made it a priority. Describing it as the cause, we have to be careful about the fact that could we be doing better on the prevention and intervention front on treating mental illness? Of course we could be, but we have to be careful when we start talking about the cause. In this particular case.
Jennifer Stuber is an assistant professor at the UW School of Social Work. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. When did that coalition arise and why?
It arose, I would say, 3 years ago. And our state, Washington State, received funding from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to try to transform its mental health system. And one of the things that our state has been focused on is on improving media portrayals as one of the ways in which we address stigma and, you know, negative public attitudes about mental illness.
What do you think stigma is doing today? Is it worse? Is it better? I mean, how has it changed in terms of people then seeking help and knowing that mental illness means there could be recovery?
Well, the research on that is quite interesting and a little bit mixed. The first piece is that we actually have shown that public attitudes over time towards mental illness are predominantly negative. And that actually the stereotype about dangerousness and violence and mental illness is actually increasing and not decreasing, despite the research evidence to the contrary. But when you actually ask the public a direct question about will they be more likely to seek services, or do they think that the treatment's available, like people's attitudes over time in that regard, and when they're asked a very direct question about would they seek services, the attitudes seem to be improving in that way, but they're not improving when it comes to the stereotypes about mental illness.
What's the timeline for that decrease or that rise in the stigma? Is that over the last
50 years?
Over the last 50 years.
We've been looking at public attitude surveys over the last 50 years.
So is there any link between the public attitude surveys that you've done and the rise in the predominance of the sensational reporting you get with
we haven't been able to make that kind of direct linkage, but that's the belief, is that the public attitudes are getting more negative, and in large part because the media portrayals, both news media, entertainment media, are also becoming more negative and more sensational.
Would you think that if the media told the health recovery stories, let's just pretend, on an equal basis with the tragedies that are then linked to mental illness, and we would have a shift, or is it sort of human nature to glom onto the negative and create a story around it?
I personally do think we would have a shift. I mean, right now what we basically see is that about 50% of the stories in news media are of the negative stereotypical type. Another 25 to 30% are about treatment system issues, treatment, mental health system issues, so more policy.
Where it's broken, though.
Right, where it's broken, exactly. And then we've got about literally like less than 10% of stories that are about focused on recovery and treatment. And I get it, that's not the kind of thing that the news wants to cover, because what's newsworthy about that? In reality, recovery happens all the time, so what's newsworthy about that? But I do think we do have an obligation, as news media, have an obligation to present a much more balanced picture. Health and mental illness.
Given this story and how this story is unfolding, the Sandy Hook story, and as we do note, there are these two narratives that are emerging. One is, do we need more gun control? The other is, there's three. Should we somehow figure out a way to secure our schools? And then the third one is, do we need to address mental health funding or treatment? What would be an educational step? What stories would you like to hear now coming out of the press?
Well, you know, in our work as a coalition, one thing that we have actually found is that in very sad, tragic incidents like the one in Newtown, Connecticut, actually become an opportunity for learning. So I showed up to this interview today not because I really wanted to be on the radio, but because I wanted to meet you and to make a relationship and
these are the triggers.
Right, exactly.
To use an unfortunate metaphor.
Exactly. But then, you know, I think it is an important, for a news organization to sit down and say to itself, like, look, you know, there is some very negative coverage that's coming out about mental health and mental illness. Maybe we should be looking for a recovery story. You know, maybe we should look for finding a young person who's, because I know it's all about the stories, right? But finding a young person who's actually, you know, successfully turned themselves around, you know, in the face of, you know, major adversity, you know, who might have been on a similar path. Like, I think this is the opportunity to kind of try to portray a more balanced approach to these issues.
So before we started, I asked you if you had any children. Mm-hmm. You said you had two. So you have a three-year-old.
I have a three-year-old and a seven-year-old.
And the three-year-old, you're not having a conversation about this at all with?
No.
Because it wouldn't help, if it even made some sense. It wouldn't help.
No, I think it would just be extremely scary.
And school would become a scary place.
Yes.
But how about the seven-year-old?
Well, my seven-year-old, I'm taking a more temperate approach. I'm kind of watching and looking and seeing what he's hearing about it. Seven is, we've actually had some trauma and death and tragedy in our family, and so I'm particularly cautious about this. But I think definitely, I haven't brought it up with him directly, but if I hear that he knows anything about it, I plan to have a very direct conversation with him about it and allow him to ask the questions and give him very honest answers. One thing I will say as a parent who has the research interest that I have is that I'm very vigilant about the kinds of things that I allow him to watch on television. I limit his media exposure to obvious exposure to violence on television, video games, And I'm also really looking into what my kids are reading in children's books, because a lot of the stereotypes about mental illness emerge in those very, very early children's books. And so I'm very vigilant about that, making sure that he has an understanding of those stereotypes in context.
So I understand that you have the data about the stereotypes and how it affects people negatively. Is there enough data that you've looked at that warrants limiting exposure to violence in media for young people?
So this isn't my area of expertise in research, but as a parent, you know, I've done my job looking into this, and absolutely there's some very strong evidence that links, you know, exposure to violence in media to children's perceptions about violence. And so we don't really understand the ways in which this could, you know, overlap with, you know, issues around mental illness, where you might have, you know, symptoms that, you know, lead to aggression or impulsivity. Does it also intersects with substance abuse, you know, which is self-medicating for issues in one's past or trauma that one's experienced. So, you know, we don't really have good data. You know, I think in a healthy child, you know, media exposure to violence is not a great thing, because it desensitizes you to violence. It makes
that we know it, that
exactly,
data we know
exactly, but we don't really have great data on how it intersects when you've got a child who's experiencing either an organic, you know, biologically based mental disorder, or is experiencing, you know, a life of trauma.
So, just sort of
exposure.
A last question about this, or last way to look at this, since you're working on the statewide coalition, got funded. This is to promote the perceptions of mental health and portrayals in the media. But you're also you're part of a larger question of how the state is treating those with mental health questions. How is the state doing? Where are the holes that you have seen? Is that also not part of your expertise?
I'm happy, because I actually teach a course on mental health policy at the University of Washington. I think you know, Washington is actually similar to a lot of states in that, you know, we have an underfunded public mental health system. I think that's pretty much endemic across the country. I think that we've got, you know, pockets of innovation. You know, I think that we've got some interesting things happening with the Affordable Care Act.
Because it brings mental health
into
funding.
It brings more people. First off, it insures more people, and it also brings about the opportunity to do better integration of, you know, health issues with mental health issues, with substance abuse disorder issues. So I think we have some really big opportunities here. But I definitely think that the cuts to the budgets and the legislature over the last few years, while mental health has been relatively well protected because we have a pretty well-educated legislature about this issue, we still, you know, have a long ways to go in terms of actually providing, you know, prevention, you know, at early ages in all the different places where you could identify kids who are having difficulties, and then actually providing services. I mean, there's a lot of people who have really fallen who can't even access care within the public-funded mental health system. And then you've also got people who are getting private insurance who aren't getting adequate care. You know, we have a long way to go in terms of integrating, you know, evidence-based practices into treatment.
Because yet we have the evidence that we know as a society now which treatments are working for even those with the most severe problems.
Absolutely. We have evidence for treatments that are working for people with even the most severe problems. We just don't routinely provide those evidence-based treatments. We have a long way to go in that regard.
Now, I was struck by one other thing I learned this week, which is that the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction has a school safety coordinator, and among what they're charged with is putting together a team in every school or in every district that can do individual assessments of students, mental health assessments among them, so that they can identify and get services to students who may be in need.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that sounds like an awful lot of work and an awful lot of people involved, and the person in charge of it basically said, yeah, like probably, and we don't have quite the funding we need to do something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. So some of the school-based health centers, you know, so we have some pockets of innovation there, but I know that it's been very challenging to kind of get them up and running, you know, in the way that they need to be, you know, in schools across the state.
All right, so leave me with what you think the consumer has to, the consumer as editor has to do when these stories arise and these questions arise about the mental health of a person involved in something. And then more broadly, when any story comes to you about where mental health or mental illness is part of the story.
Well, I think it's just not jumping to the conclusion. Like even if the journalist is making that mistake, or the person the journalist is interviewing is making that mistake of jumping to the conclusion that, you know, the simple, overly simplistic conclusion that mental illness causes violence, which it does not. And understanding that it's really about the broader context of the person's life, and that can play a role in violence. And so
ask ourselves the other questions.
Ask ourselves
and maybe
the other
get
questions
the press to do it as well.
Exactly. Ask ourselves the other questions that are really, really important, and not just jumping to conclusions. And knowing that the vast majority of people who have a mental illness are never involved in violence, and knowing that we're all vulnerable to mental illness in our lives. And so when we make that equate mental illness with violence, we're really, you know, creating a larger set of societal problems. And actually contributing to the issues around not treating mental health, ironically, because we're creating the stereotypes, we're creating the stigma.
Yeah, and a sense that there's no way out. You're forlorn. You can't really deal with it.
You're not, and you're contributing to the social isolation that I think is really a big part of these events as well. That individuals who engage in these kinds of violent mass killings are very much on the outside, socially excluded, socially isolated, because they were just showing signs that they were different, that they were not like everybody else.
Dr. Jennifer Stuber is assistant professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. Thank you.
Thank you.